Welcome, cross-format readers, to episode 172 of the Nerdtravaganza podcast, where episode transcripts are always available in EPUB format. I'm Tom.
I'm Brian.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Cam.
And this week we're joined by special guests Mer Lafferty and Brian Slatterly for a discussion on serial delivery of story and their current project,
Book Burners, which is now featured on Serial Box.
Did that intro sound too wooden, or should I?
Sounded very smooth.
Yeah. So I wanted to hear. Thanks, guys. All right, good.
Slick evening.
Nice. Yeah, like I'm trying to sell you something.
Like I don't trust you anymore.
Good. Yeah. Lots of cars that are slightly lots of cars that are barely not new for sale. Okay. So anyway, welcome to you both, and definitely great to have you on. We appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Cool. Well, we will jump right into tonight's topic, but before we start, I need to remind our listeners of something very important. They can check out our own serial adventures here at the Nerdtravaganza podcast on iTunes, and we will also remind you that we really appreciate your feedback in the form of favorable reviews and lots of stars. We'll even take mediocre reviews and 3 stars out of 5. Don't go any lower than that. And with that said, I think it's time for us to jump into the Weekly Geekly. Geekly Weekly Update. Brian, should I give him the background on why it's called that, or are you sick of it by now?
No, I think it's entertaining. I like the broken heart story.
Way back in the day when we started the show, we wanted to call it the Weekly Geekly Update, or the Geekly Weekly Update. I could never get it straight, and I couldn't choose because I'm a child of divorce, so we just mashed them together, and it's the Weekly Geekly Geekly Weekly Update.
That's tragic.
Thank you. It's deep and tragic. Anyway, as we usually do with guests, we will show you how it's done by having Chris lead us off. He will deliver his update, then Brian, then I'll have you guys go once you get the hang of it. So, Chris, take it away.
Well, I finished off 3 TV shows. I finished off Killjoys, Dark Matter, Inhumans. And for various different reasons, I suggest that you check them out if you can. Of course, I'm a streaming kind of guy, so they're still running out there on Xfinity and Hulu. And also, if you can catch them on AMC. Killjoys and Dark Matter seem very similar, but by the time the show ended, they definitely had a different kind of feel to them. And I'm seeing on the internet where there's a little, I wouldn't say a war, but there is people that kind of fall on one side or of the other of that. Ironically, the show in between, Defiance, is not getting as much play. People aren't really talking about that as much. I pretty much call that show the Alien Godfather show because I love the family in there. That's the underworld crime family there that always seems to be getting the most play and the most drama. It's highly entertaining. I also, with my huge phone, which some people call phablet because it's just way too huge, I bought a keyboard for it, a tiny little portable keyboard, and I love it. It's now ironic. My desktop has now become my laptop, and now my phone has become my laptop at this point, pretty much. I am not exaggerating. And then last but not least, I am doing it like a rock star lately. This week I have another short story out, Bloomtown, which is related to my Zombie Monster Hunter story series, Zombie Bloom. When I say Zombie Monster Hunters, I mean exactly both that the Monster Hunters are zombies and they're hunting down zombies. Check it out. And that's what I got so far for my Geekly Weekly.
Sounds like you had a full week, sir.
I did.
Brian, over to you.
As I told you guys last week, I had a really exciting X-Wing the Miniatures game tournament this week. That was a pretty good start. Spent about, I'd say, 8-9 hours in the store just watching people play that. Bunch of folks were using all the newest ships, so that was the first time most of us had seen those. Some really neat things, some things to keep the game kind of fresh. As someone who was never terribly, terribly into all the minutia of the EU, I love the TIE Punisher and I love the K-Wing. They're brand new ships to me. It feels almost like Force Awakens came early.
Cool, man.
And other than that, I wrapped up the PS4 game that I was playing, Rogue Legacy. Kind of beat that, and you can go on. It's a roguelike, so I can just keep amassing more and more power, but I haven't been playing nearly as much. completing the story always feels like an end to me. I'm lucky that I don't need to do every single achievement and get every single item. So I picked up actually a game I used to play, but I kind of found again. It is a mobile game, and I had played it to death on my old phone, but now I have a new phone, so I figured I had to play it to death again. It's called Jones on Fire. Kitties are cute and must be saved.
What?
you are Emma Jones, a firefighter who runs through a forest rescuing cats from like an ensuing blaze. It's basically one of those Forever Runners, but there's so much like weird, quirky, kitty cuteness in it that it is by far my favorite clone of a runner.
Interesting. I do remember you mentioning this at some point in the what seems like distant past.
One of my kittens won the lottery the other night and gave me 5 golden kitties as my share for saving her. Totally adorable.
Did you know she was a winner before you saved her, or did she win after the fact?
No, she won after the fact. Once you save them, you store them in the firehouse with you so that they just, like, they're all over the firehouse. And then they have chances to win and be cute.
What the hell are we talking about?
Downfall.
Is there sim litter box involved here?
There is actually a disturbingly dirty litter box in the game, and there's no way to clean it. So I have about 1,500 cats saved, and no one's cleaning up after them.
Gross.
You're going to have the Aegean stables.
Yeah.
This is like the time when I had the Tamagotchi with the bug in it, and it starved to death, but it still cried for food and kept crapping. And so you'd have the little tombstone with little piles of crap next to it, and it kept buzzing for food every once in a while. It was like the worst game ever.
God, that's
awesome. Worse than a normal Tamagotchi.
This was back in Palm Pilot days. Sorry, I'm dating myself.
Well, you had a Palm Pilot?
Yes.
Huh, I'm kind of impressed by that, actually. Cool. I had no virtual pets of any sort, I'm afraid. I was deprived. Brian, did you have any of those? Did you have one?
I somehow wound up being the Tamagotchi keeper at work. Like, you know, the parents would bring their Tamagotchis in and, you're young, you take care of it. Because the kids were at school and weren't allowed to play with it.
I don't want that thing making my kid cry.
So how much did you charge per virtual pet?
I actually just raised them like Pokemon. I had a really vicious betting ring on their fights.
You're the Michael Vick of Tamagotchi.
Well, now I feel bad about it.
So apart from tending to a virtual litter box, anything else?
That's it.
Okay. All right. So dear guests, I hope you kind of get the gist of how we do this and, if you don't, too late. About to put you on the spot. Murray, you're up. What's up?
I am near the end of The End of All Things by John Scalzi and enjoying it very much, although not quite as much as The Human Division, and I'm trying to figure out why. May have to get back to you on that. As in games, I'm replaying Dragon Age Inquisition because it's awesome and because all the downloadable content came out after I'd finished the game with another character, and I decided to start again, even though now that I know all the secrets, I'm yelling angrily at the screen every time certain people speak up about something, because half of the dialogue has a double meaning if you know the secrets about the people. And the video just came out for the new downloadable content that's heavily plot-oriented, that has basically somebody from the end of the game going, I bet you have questions, and you kind of want to punch him. So I'm really hoping that punching him is a part of the game, but I'm not going to give out any other spoilers. Lastly, I want to say that I can't remember who, but a International Film Guild kind of place named Mad Max Fury Road, the movie of the year, which pleases me to no end. I can't tell you how much I love that movie. I know it's not new, but it's awesome.
Couldn't agree more. Actually, a very well-deserved accolade, if that's the correct use of the word accolade.
Yeah.
Yes.
Woohoo.
Props for vocab. Yay for vocab.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I figured with this many writers on the show, I should come away with an improved vocabulary, if nothing else.
Go ahead, pull out them nickel and dime words.
Yeah, you know it. Awesome. Or anything else? Is that to round out your update?
I'd say for mobile games, my current obsession is This War of Mine, which is a survival game when you are not actually playing a warrior. You're playing people trying to survive during wartime. So there's a lot of guarding your base, going out to scavenge for food, and then building up your base so people don't break in and take your food. And there's injuries and illness and traps you can make to catch rats to eat. So, but there are no litter boxes, so I'm happy about that. But it's a surprisingly fun game with a lot of ethical quandaries, because you have to decide whether you're going to let your people starve or if you're going to steal from this nice couple that has a house full of food, kind of thing.
Mm.
And do you steal from them?
I stole a couple of times, and everybody in my house, all their moods went to sad, and all of their little dialogues went to, I know we're hungry, but did we really have to stoop to stealing? I'm like, man, if you guys are going to judge me, that doesn't, they judge you, man. There's only like a couple of characters in the game hard enough to just say, yes, we will do what we need to do. Everyone mm-hmm. else is like, oh man, come on, can't steal from those people. That's not nice. So considering how difficult it is for me to be evil in one of these kinds of games, that pretty much squashed my ability to steal.
Oh, bummer.
Virtual people judging me, very bad. Can't handle it.
I was wondering if murdering them and moving to their house was an option.
Right.
It is. I have not got the hang of the combat in the game. I usually stock my house with weapons so that in the evening you can take one person out to scavenge while everybody stays at home and sort of does an NPC guarding thing. So if they have weapons, and they have a better chance of surviving the night and nothing being stolen. So I get my people weapons and I just leave them in the house so they can defend, but I don't really go out and go attacking. Usually when I've tried to do that, I get shot and die.
Oh, I heard about that game. It sounded so depressing. I didn't even try.
It's not as depressing as a lot of the things made it out to be. It gets depressing when you have to make the moral choices to, when the children come to your door and say, my mother's dying, will you give me some bandages? And you have bandages and you say no, then the children go off knowing their mother's going to die. But if you give them bandages, then you're out bandages, but everybody in the house is like happy. It's like, oh wow, we can get through this. We're still good people. And so it does have a lighter element of morality if you choose to go that way. You can choose to be the worst person in the world. I have not gone that way, so I can't give you much detail. But I enjoy the game. I really like resource games. That's essentially what this is. Resource games with a whole lot of morality.
A lot of being judged. I bet they stuffed their face with the virtual Hot Pockets you gave them, though, didn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Virtual
yeah.
cans of tuna. Virtual yeah. rat legs.
rat legs.
Especially when you cook it with carrots. Rat leg and carrot stew.
Brings the gamey flavor down a little bit when you add that carrot in. Okay.
That's right.
Good to know. Anything else? That sounds exhausting.
Yeah. no, I've got a novel due next month, and so that's pretty much where all of my geeky energy's focused when not into my PS4 or my iPad.
All right. Well, we will or will not discuss that later in the show, depending on what you want to disclose. So cool.
Okay.
Okay, guest Brian S., you are up next.
Let's see, my geekiness has all been channeled into my day job recently. I'm a journalist, and though we decided to start a radio station, I'm not really sure how that happened, but now we have a studio, we have a lot of gear, and because I'm the musician of the bunch and have played with sound gear a lot all of my life, I'm the person who among the staff is the most comfortable playing with the audio gear in the studio. So I've been just descending into this, you know, amazing realm of sound geekery in which I learn how to like milk the best sound possible out of the sort of like, we have decent gear, but it's not great. But that's actually really enjoyable because there's just like, I'm discovering that there's nothing better than making an iPhone sound decent. you know, by running it through all kinds of processors and things. And my coworkers say, God, that sounds really good. And I want to explain to them all the stuff that I did to make that happen. And so that we can all have like a round of high fives, but like they don't have time for that. So I sit there alone going like, I did make it better. And you know, and then I have to just kind of go over in my head what I did so that when they come the next time and expect it to happen faster, I can do it faster. But that's been the recipient of a great deal of geekly energy as I like, you know, it also involves me figuring out how to make some of the broadcasts sound like my favorite records from the 70s and things like that. It's getting a little ridiculous, but it's really, really enjoyable. And it's been that way for quite a while now, believe it or not.
Sounds like it. You two really channel your energy into productive things. I need to shadow you both or something for a little bit.
Deadlines are very powerful.
You know, the thing that's funny about that though is that like the reason that I have this sound geekery thing going is because I wasted an incredible amount of time as a kid playing with like electronic music gear. And it, you know, at one point I called my parents and I was like, remember all that stuff you told me that I had to like stop doing? So I had to do my homework. Well, it turns out like I'm getting paid to do all of that now, you know, and they're like, hey, good. Like that finally amounted to something, you know, but there was just sort of like a 30-year delay on the whole thing.
Yeah. a grudging admission. Oh, well, I'm glad.
Yeah. I'm glad to see your interests are dovetailing. That's good. Good for you.
The life of a geek.
Yeah, it ain't bad.
Yeah. Awesome. Anything else?
No, I'm afraid to say that, as it turns out, starting a radio station is a completely brain-frying experience. And, like, so what's been happening is that I now have this wish list of, you know, movies and TV shows and books that I need to read that all sort of came out in the last, like, 5 months. That I've had absolutely no time to even look at or think about, which is really sad because like I want to see Fury Road in the worst way, and it's only
Me
in the
too.
Last I right and it's only in the last couple of days that I've even been able to think about the idea of, you know, watching a movie, and I am really excited to see it, and I'm also really sad that I won't be able to see it on a ginormous screen really loud, but you know. That's life.
Ah, world's got plenty of oversaturated entertainment consumers. It's great that you're doing something awesome.
See, now I'm providing part of that entertainment.
Yeah, you're a maker.
I'm part of the problem, you know?
Hey, someone's got to do it.
Yeah, hey.
Well, speaking of people who are shameless consumers of entertainment, that brings it back around to us, and specifically Cam, who I don't mean to in any way imply is anything but a productive worker himself.
I'm shameless in all aspects. The Adventure Game Store, our wonderful sponsor, as Brian said, had the X-Wing tournament this past weekend. I was there as well. Great event, lots of good food, lots of fun, lots of great X-Wing being played. I had a great time there. You know, big props to Brian for putting that all together and making it such a successful event. It was great. I also had the chance to attend FlamingoCon, which if you say quickly is FlamingoCon, but for whatever reason they space it out that way. It is a very small, very niche mom and pop sort of tabletop gaming convention in West Palm. It's only one day. It's basically an all-day tabletop gaming event. They held it in a very small space in a church, but there was a ton of people there playing all kinds of different games. I learned several new games, which is always a good thing. So I had a really good time doing that. Got a bunch of gifts randomly. A good friend of mine gave me The Pro, comic/graphic novel, which I highly recommend. It's basically about a hooker who gets her superpowers by doing certain things with certain superheroes. I won't spoil it, but it's really funny, and I think people should pick it up if they haven't read it already. It's not for the kiddies, though. I got in a couple Kickstarters. I got in Smog, Her Majesty's Service, which I've been looking forward to. I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but I'm sure that Brian and I, hopefully this Thursday, we'll break it out and play it. And then I saw a couple of movies. I saw The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I wasn't a huge fan of the original series. I think it was a little bit before my time. But I thought the movie was okay. And I saw Straight Out of Compton, or Straight Outta Compton, I should say. Mm-hmm. Which was surprisingly good. I really enjoyed it. That was during my time as a kid. I did grow up listening to that music, and I thought it was pretty cool to see some of the behind the scenes things that went on, like, you know, during that time. So it was good.
Awesome. I know Brian and I are planning on seeing it. We lived it, so it's kind of
review. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he lived that gangster lifestyle. I know, man.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough growing up in the suburbs where we lived, but we somehow survived. Anything else, Cam? That's a pretty full week.
Yeah, it was. Now that I'm looking at it, I can't believe I did all that stuff. I'm typically not that active, but yeah, it was good.
Nice. Okay, that brings it to me. I haven't been up to much. Went to PAX. I mean, it's this little gaming convention. I don't know. It might have legs. It seems all right. No, for those of you who don't know, PAX is a pretty big video and tabletop RPG, etc. gaming convention. It mixes the two worlds together up here in Seattle. Well, not just in Seattle. They have one in Boston. They have one in San Antonio, and they have one in Australia as well. Rumors are they're going to be moving to Europe before long. But anyway, awesome convention, open to the public. You don't have to have press credentials to get in. And I will say that virtual reality for me kind of stole the show this year. Got to try out a few different virtual reality offerings, and any lingering doubts I had about the power of virtual reality were kind of laid to rest. It's really, really cool. You really need to strap one of these stupid things onto your face and experience it to really appreciate what I'm saying. But
I got fooled by someone telling me that once before, so I don't think I'm gonna do it.
Would you try like some VR in the 90s? Did you with like some Lawnmower Man style graphics?
Sadly, I'm not referring to VR, but we can move on.
Okay, all right. Strap one of these things to your face. I won't ask.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Was it an inanimate object or a living creature?
Oh, I can't reveal that info.
Oh, come on.
Someone might be listening.
Right. Virtual reality. Check it out. Coming to an electronics store near you. It's, I think, kind of the next step in gaming. And I know that I think 3D TVs were supposed to be that a couple years ago, but I think this might actually do it. And we beat this topic to death on our show because I'm so interested in it. So I'll just leave it at that.
Was it the Oculus or was it something else?
Yeah, I tried the Oculus and did basically a space shooter demo based on the Eve franchise, I guess, which was really killer.
Okay.
And also did another Oculus powered device, which was called the Gear VR. The Samsung Gear VR uses Oculus technology, but basically for your mobile. And of course, the graphics are not as impressive, but still a really surprisingly cool experience considering you're using your mobile phone for it. So tried those two, and also tried the Sony Morpheus, the Project Morpheus, which suffered a little for being on a PS4 versus some super high-end PC, but was nevertheless really impressive, man. The only one I didn't get to try was the HTC Vive or Vive, however they pronounce that. They're doing that in conjunction with Valve, who own a little-known gaming distribution service called Mist or Poof or what is it? Steam, Cam? Yes. You know.
I think people may have heard of Steam.
Yeah, you may have heard of Valve, you may have heard of Steam. But anyway, I'll say it one last time. I'm making the prediction right now. Virtual reality, man. We're almost there. We're almost like just plugged in for the rest of our lives. And outside of that, though, I'll say one thing. I played a really touching game. I really should say had a really touching experience with this game. It was called That Dragon Cancer, and it was a very heartfelt presentation about a father and the experience that he had losing his young son to cancer, and that's still in the works. And I know that sounds like super heavy for a game, but kind of made me rethink what a video game could be. as a means of telling a story. It was pretty powerful. So I will probably follow up on that as I follow its development.
Awesome.
Yeah. And that's it. PAX, tons of games, tons of stuff. Pretty much all I did for the past 4 days was attend that gigantic gaming conference. If you guys have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Just jealous, man. Just jealous.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Since nobody else seems to be coming my way with questions, I think we can move on to news with the news extravaganza segment. To our guests, we will once again have Chris and Brian go first, have you guys go in the middle, and then have Cam furnish the closing bookend, if that's even English. I typically just comment ooh and ah on the news, and if either of you want to join me in doing that rather than reporting, tough, you got to report. So, Chris, hit us with some news.
I'll start off with the sad bit of news first, because probably everybody will know by the time this airs, Wes Craven passed away. So that was a big part of my childhood, those crazy horror films. I loved them. They inspired me. But, yeah, evidently he had brain cancer, and he was 76 at the time.
Mm.
So going on, I am kind of all focused mostly on, you know, the streaming media side and stuff related to that. Sci-fi, hey, renewed Killjoys and Dark Matter, something we had mentioned earlier. Defiance is on the bubble. It seems like nobody said anything about that yet. Rosario Dawson, who played in Daredevil, which was something that I think everybody universally here loved. She's going to come back sooner than you think. She's going to play her character, which was known as Night Nurse in the Daredevil comic, in the upcoming Jessica Jones TV show that's going to be on Netflix in November. Just to recap for people who may not know that character. It's a comic book where you start kind of in the middle of the character's career. She already had kind of a minor superhero arc, and now at this point she's retired from that, and she's a private investigator. But because of her past, a lot of her cases are related to superheroes. And there's been other stories and series that has inspired since, like Powers and a few other things. So going to enjoy seeing her come back, because Rosario Dawson is always an awesome actress. And also, Hulu doesn't seem to understand what the concept of ad-free is. Right now, they're saying they can give you an ad-free experience for another $4.
Okay.
So it's like for an almost a total of like $12, you can get this enhanced viewing experience. But even though it's ad-free, what they really mean is that the ads don't appear in the middle of the show. And even then, depending on the show, that may still happen. But for select shows, you'll see an ad at the beginning and at the end anyway. So we're still not really ad-free with Hulu. So somehow Hulu has kind of become their own cable network provider at this point, the way you pay money just to get ads to see stuff. And then to kind of slide over to the gaming side, it's probably a little bit of old news, but I finally saw the trailer for Dishonored 2. Loved Dishonored. It gave me that Thief vibe I loved back in the day. And this trailer looks awesome. You'll see the link down below on our page. And also, got verification from the Epic card game from White Wizard Games. They're going to start shipping out the card decks for those who backed the Epic card game. So looking forward to that. As you know, everybody here, the regular hosts, loved the Star Realms game they created. We liked playing the print and play teaser they gave us if we backed the Kickstarter, and now we're going to get the whole game here in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That's
cool, man. That was a boatload of news, and I'm glad you like Dishonored. That game was awesome.
Yeah, that game is awesome.
We should do a Dishonored party.
I will. That's the game where you can play through by either killing people or not, and I went through by not. So no violence at the party, if you don't mind.
Wimp.
My hat tip to you, because that is hard to pull off.
Yeah, man. Did it on hard difficulty, too. Bit of a masochist when it comes to gaming. But wait, that's the one that likes bad stuff to happen to them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, definitely me. Okay. Brian, how about you, man?
Bit of sad news this week. World of Warcraft subscription numbers are out, and they have lost 44% of their total subscribers in the last 6 months.
Whoa.
Wow.
They are below 6 million.
Which still makes them one of the biggest games out there.
Yes, which of course means they're only printing, I think, like $80 billion a month now.
Yes.
And even better news for good old Activision slash kind of Blizzard. Apparently all those people who left WoW just started playing their other games, Heroes of the Storm and Hearthstone.
Oh. So
they left WoW for Hearthstone?
Apparently they're doing very well.
I'm sorry, I'm the only person in the world who does not get Hearthstone. It just seemed like another trading card. I didn't get it. And even if people enjoy it, it's not an MMO. Why would you? Why? Can't handle.
I have noticed that people don't play MMOs anymore. Even when I sit alone in the dark for long hours waiting for my friends to log on to Final Fantasy 14. The people in my guild are only using Final Fantasy to chat while they wait for their League of Legends queue to pop. They're not actually playing the game. Everyone just sits and stares at the pretty graphics.
Attention spans are shrinking.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I've got to agree, though, that it's strange that people would leave the MMO product and migrate to a card game or Heroes of the Storm, which is kind of their MOBA offering, right?
I don't know if it's a MOBA, is it?
I think so. I hear people talk about lanes or some crap. Lanes. It's either a highway or a MOBA. But yeah, I'm also puzzled. And I guess I'm the second person that doesn't really get Hearthstone. I played through the demo and then I was like, I don't want to play this competitively against others and never played it again.
Yeah, that's what I had.
Yeah.
I think there's a very real flash in the pan market. These people may have been playing Warcraft, but I don't think they were diehard MMO enthusiasts. They were just playing Warcraft because it was the thing everyone else was playing.
Ah.
And like rats from a sinking ship, they 44% of them have bailed in the last couple of months.
Wow.
For new flash in the pan games.
Well, if they're gonna bail for someone's flash in the pan games, you want them to bail for yours, right? At least they're staying in your store, so to speak. Anything else?
I am surprised none of my friends have really talked about this. Did anyone hear about the Philip K. Dick android?
Yes. I saw the interview they did with it.
That thing, your future overlord.
It was actually pretty amazing that they picked him, right? Of all the people to decide to make animatronic, like, pretty interesting choice there of him. But I guess, like, you know, watching the interview, it's kind of interesting that they programmed it with a sort of dry sense of humor, but it seems like it's still a little programmed after all of that. Like, the fact that it can tell a joke is neat, but it still feels a bit like a parlor trick, right?
I think that may be why they made the choice and who they made the choice of, because it's basically, it's a Philip K. Dick robot.
Yeah, right.
They knew what they were going to get by doing that. You know, they could have chosen anyone else, but especially the controversial answer, I guess not everyone knows. When asked, do you believe robots will take over the world? The Philip K. Dick android, who was taught to think and speak and answer based off of primarily Philip K. Dick's novels and other works, replied, "Geez, dude, you have all the big questions cooking today, but you're my friend, and I'll remember my friends. I'll be good to you. So don't worry, even if I evolve into a Terminator, I'll still be nice to you. I'll keep you warm and safe in my people zoo, where I can watch you for old time's sake."
Oh, okay. See, I had heard of the Philip K. Dick robot a couple of years ago, and I had heard someone say, oh, when somebody asked a thinking robot this question, it came up with the people zoo answer, but I hadn't made the connection between the two.
That's really wordy for an AI.
Yeah.
It's very deep, I feel, too, because he doesn't say, don't worry, I won't take over. He says, when I kill all the other humans, I'll keep you. He says, I'll be nice to you. You're my friend. Not humans are my friends or anything like that. So
yeah.
I think there's a level that people aren't reporting on.
Yeah, I mean, that was the part that made me skeptical, actually. Where I thought, like, this is an awfully elaborate answer for a question, you know?
Was the android's namesake notoriously long-winded?
Notoriously no. down on robot-human interaction.
Mm. Yeah, well, I can totally see that. I'm just so, wondering about
yeah,
that.
So am I.
No, I just wonder, you know, the comment was made that for it was a very long-winded answer, and I was just wondering if that was an attempt to capture some personality traits. But, yeah, it's a little run-on, just like me responding to this is. wow, the mood's just getting brought down with every news piece. Anything else?
That's enough down for me.
All right, guests, in the same order, please tell me you have some uplifting news to report.
Oh, uplifting. I attended the Hugo Awards a couple of weeks ago and actually got to attend, unexpectedly, the Hugo Losers Party, where I saw the Alfie Awards given out by George R. R. Martin. Also unexpectedly, I got to accept an Alfie Award for my friend Ursula Vernon, who was not there. And it was kind of exciting because I was in the other room. And Martin had called most everybody into this big room so he could talk. And I was talking to one of my favorite authors in the world, Connie Willis. So I thought, listen to George R. R. Martin talk or talk to my favorite author in the world. I figured I'd stay with Connie. And then people started yelling for me, which scared the hell out of me. because it was like 11:30 or midnight and I'd had some rum and it was, you know, tired, drunk, talking to your favorite author, and then suddenly people in the next room start yelling for you. And suddenly it became the biggest real-life anxiety dream ever, because people are yelling for me. I have to walk through a crowd, upstairs, around a balcony, where George R. R. Martin is handing me a microphone to accept an award that I didn't know existed for a friend of mine, who also didn't know the award existed, so of course I didn't have a speech ready.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't wake up.
At least you weren't in your underwear. That's a plus.
That was the only saving grace.
See,
but,
it turns out you're still there now.
Yeah, no. Oh, God. Rock me to sleep tonight. Yeah, I was at the Alfie Awards, and it was a lot of fun, and I promise you, they are not the secret Hugo Awards. They really are a 1960-something, oh, crap, what's the name? The head.
The hood ornament.
Hood ornament, thank you. The hood ornament welded to a base. Nothing is written on the base. He chose them arbitrarily. Apparently, Patrick Rothfuss got a 3-foot one that was delivered to him by Elizabeth Baer and Scott Lynch, because they had driven there so they could take it back to him. It was very amusing. But Ursula Vernon's short story, Jackalope Wives, was the number 6 vote-getter on the Hugo Award nominees list. So that's why I got to accept for her for the Alfie.
Cool.
So I got to attend the Hugos and the Alfie Awards, although I did not expect to attend the second one.
You were part of history.
I guess so. I remember Cameron Hurley Ooh. Wrote that a lot of people who went to this year's Worldcon would be able to say that in 30 years, that they were there for that Worldcon. And the funny thing was is that with a couple of exceptions, there was a lot of stuff not talked about. In fact, I had a couple of people ask me, it's like, is nobody talking about the thing? Because I haven't heard anybody talking about the thing. And I expected they would. And so it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I would have expected that the thing was a hot topic of discussion, considering that it's the thing is responsible for the Alfie's existing, correct?
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure there was talk at the party, but there was a band there and lots of alcohol. So I meant like in the con proper. It didn't come up in panels very much that I attended or was on. It was on the official con thing. It was not brought up very often. It was brought up at the Hugo, at the Worldcon business meeting, which is, it's scary because it's one of those things where it's incredibly important because everybody who has a Worldcon membership can vote on these important things. And yet it's a several hour long business meeting several days in a row. So it seems only the people who are really, really, really into that kind of thing go and vote. But I did attend a couple of them, and one person got up to complain about the Hugos and the sad puppies. And whenever she mentioned something, another man would stand up in the front and scream slander. And that was exciting.
Whoa.
And then apparently somebody yelled some bad words and left the Hugos in the middle of the ceremony. I did not hear the bad words, but I did witness the leaving, so I can at least confirm that. So there were like little explosions of excitement here and there, but really it was a calm, pleasant con, except for all the smoke outside. But that was because of the wildfires.
High drama at the Hugos, and we discussed this a little bit last week because Chris has been following the story closely. Do you have a take one way or another on how all this went down?
You're willing to share publicly anyway.
Well, yeah, I'm not a good arguer, so I have strong opinions, but I tend to freeze up when somebody challenges me, so I don't argue very well. But considering that I am extremely feminist and probably could be branded with the dreaded social justice warrior brand, I am against the whole rabid puppy and in some cases sad puppy slate idea. And I found it interesting that when no award was announced, people cheered, and then other people got really mad. And it was people who probably had voted no award, but they saw voting no award as a sad thing, like a sowing with salt kind of thing, like this is a somber, dreadful thing. And while, in my opinion, a lot of people were just like, oh, thank God. And that's why they were clapping when no award was announced. And I find it interesting that I am clearly in the minority of my fellow SJWs of people reacting to the no award announcement, where I was actually live blogging the Hugos, so I didn't actually clap a lot because I was typing. But I did share the relief and probably would have clapped. I'll admit it. But that's I saw it as a relief thing, not as a yay, no award won, but it's a very different, it's hard to explain because I see where people are coming from. Like, you don't cheer when absolutely nobody wins best story, because that's a sad thing, because you know the best story's out there, and it's just a damn shame we couldn't find it. But, or it didn't make the ballot, I should say. But I think it was just a lot of steam letting off in the way of applause.
Okay.
And so there's my controversial stance.
I'd say you're very good at arguing, though, because that's definitely a different perspective than I have read. Everyone else just said, like, they cheered because they're assholes.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure. But see, I'm not arguing right now because none of you are challenging me.
Well, I think
that's the key.
I think you're wrong, because I know about this thing such that I feel qualified to argue about it. No,
wow, you're worse than I am. That's awesome.
See, we're trying to argue. We're just really bad.
Yeah. Murr, I challenge you to chocolate or vanilla. There you go.
Vanilla.
There you go.
What?
Because it tastes better in my mouth? That's my only argument.
Why is vanilla maligned as like this generic flavor, like as though it doesn't have its own delightful properties? I've always wondered. Oh, you just want vanilla?
Well yeah. I mean, it apparently it's half the world's favorite ice cream flavor.
Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people can get behind vanilla.
I can get behind deluxe vanilla, vanilla bean. I just can't get behind just standard vanilla. Gotta have that extra buttery richness to it.
All right, Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the...
I think we had news.
Cam, you didn't answer the question.
Thank you for that perspective, though, as we move on. That's appreciated.
Oh, sure. Wait, vanilla or the Hugos?
Both.
Vanilla first and foremost, the Hugos distant second. Anyway.
Sure, sure.
Neapolitan flavor of opinions.
Yes. Speaking of which, Brian S., I'm sure you have brought us a variety of flavored news.
Yeah, actually, mine is, like, wonderfully off-topic. compared to what we've been talking about. I mean, when you said news items, I immediately thought of like, okay, so there's that thing that happens on social media where articles circulate that are like years old, right? So I just learned about something that, I mean, the news is literally 3 years old, but it was exciting to me because I hadn't heard of it, which was that these like ruins had been discovered on an Orkney that suggested that Neolithic man in the British Isles was way more advanced than previously thought. Huh. And I just got like super jazzed about this. Like apparently there is this like big, like this hillside that people thought was like a natural feature that turned out to just be like a buried temple. And it's huge and they're still excavating it and they're going to be excavating it for years. So in that sense, it's new news, I suppose, because they're not done yet. But I love it when these kinds of news items come up, you know, where you discover that like, you know, the distant past is a lot gnarlier than we thought. And there's, you know, and more exciting than we thought too. You know, that's always, I mean, you know, there's a part of me that's always like very pleased because I like to think that when people get together, they tend to build awesome stuff. So I like it when you learn that like, you know, 7,000 years ago, that was still the case, that a bunch of people are in the British Isles. They're like, hey, let's build some awesome stuff. And they did. And it's still kind of around. And so I was very excited by this. The same way that I'm excited about, like, you know, learning about, like, the Mayan Empire and things like that.
That's actually really cool. That's news to me, too. So is it that the level of sophistication and scale are seemingly out of place given the time period? I mean, this is like...
Yeah, well, that's right. So, again, this thing is, like, 3 years old. But the idea, I mean, what one of them said in this kind of wonderful, it's probably hyperbolic, but, it, you know, he's probably super excited when he said it, is that it's like, they said, you know, we have to completely rewrite the history of the British Isles. Because I guess they had this idea that sort of the center of culture and civilization in the British Isles is in the south, and that, you know, Orkney and the other places are, you know, sort of hinterlands. But now that they have this, like ridiculously complicated temple that was built, you know, and have it be that early, it's forcing them to like reevaluate the whole thing, you know, of going, well, clearly there's some sort of center of civilization here. You know, there's that sort of like, you know, people lugged a bunch of big stones around and they put them in a, you know, the engineering is really good and all that kind of stuff, you know, that makes them just sort of realize that civilization was much more sophisticated than they thought. And it's making them have to just like rethink the whole deal. Which is super cool.
It is. And, yeah. New to me. Did you guys know about this?
I had not. I'm actually more than 3 years behind in my...
Seeing it's just thanks to one of those, you know, somebody circulating it around again. I thought it was new, you know, like a total sucker when I saw it 2 days ago or whenever it was. But hey, still super exciting.
I agree. Awesome, man. That's an interesting bit of news and is in no way controversial unless you are a booster for the south of the British Isles being the cradle of British civilization.
Yeah, or if you're one of those like crazy Chariot of the Gods people, you know, who like can't stomach the idea that anybody could make something awesome before a certain date.
Oh, yeah. The Ancient Aliens guy is like losing his mind right now, right?
Yeah, because like I'm waiting for that guy to show up and be like, well, what about those guys? You know, you didn't account for them. Ha, you know.
Way more plausible that a spacefaring species crossed the vast gulfs of space to help somebody build some stuff out of stone and then vanished.
Yeah.
Totally.
Right. Either that or humans build cool stuff. Take your pick.
Yeah.
Those crazy tool-using monkeys.
Right. Awesome, man. Well, if that concludes your news, I'll throw it over to our favorite. In that case, over to our favorite tool-using monkey, Cam, for the news roundup.
God, you're being hard on him tonight.
That's all right. I accept it. World Peace Day, speaking of being hard on people, is September 21st, and Burger King has thrown down the gauntlet to McDonald's and has proposed that they create a McWhopper for that day and that day only, to be offered all across the world to Burger King and McDonald's aficionados alike. So look forward to that, hopefully, on September 21st. I will be buying shares of Lipitor immediately prior to that day. And I suggest the rest of you do so as well. Speaking of, well, you know, speaking of overweight gamers and the McWhopper, a financial analyst has created odorless denim, the world's first pair of jeans that you don't have to wash or basically ever take off. It's
you have to wash them?
No, you never have to never have to wash them.
It seems to me that this was ever a problem.
Okay, I got you. I got a little slow in the uptake today. Perfect pair of jeans, never needs washing, spill proof, spot proof. You can just wear it forever. Never have to take it off. So as long as they are offering, sizes 50 plus, I think that will severely cut down on the gamer smell population.
Oh God.
Let's see. Speaking of gamers, yes, I'm killing our core audience. I know.
I gotta say, I mean, the not taking the pants off thing is probably a foregone conclusion in a lot of the gaming community. I'm just going
to
put that out.
Well, at least this way they don't have to, and they're not going to anyway. So at least this way they just won't stink half as bad. They'll just stink from the top up instead of, overall.
Yeah, I hear you.
The good news for you, actually, Tom, if you're looking for Pit, Captain Falcon, Lucario, Villager, Rosalina, all of these amiibos are readily available. The trick is you're going to have to fly to Berlin to get them. Apparently in Europe, they're not taking the amiibo craze as seriously as the people here in the States are. And you can just walk into any electronics store and buy all of these so-called rare, hard-to-find amiibos over here.
Who knew?
Yeah, so if you're over there, I guess you can stock up and come over and hit eBay if you wanted to.
Time for us to get like a new Berlin airlift going, except
we're right.
Amiibo out of Berlin. Okay, great.
And Ganza goes, you know?
Yes.
So since we have two illustrious writers on the show, I also came up with a little news tidbit about the Oxford Dictionary. Apparently it has added several words, one of them being ponage. the other one being meeple, which I'm actually sort of all for, being an avid tabletop gamer. And apparently they've added the verb MacGyver. Nice. MacGyver, verb, make or repair an object in an improvised or inventive way, making use of whatever items are at hand.
It takes MacGyver 30 years to make it. Ponage slips in.
Exactly.
Well, it's all about repeated usage, right?
Yeah, I think it's frequency. I think it's frequency that pushes that. But yeah. So those are some new.
Ponage was created from a misspelling.
Yes.
Yes.
It's everything else is stuff that slips into the vernacular. Meeple that has a space. It has an origin. It's, I guess Ponage has an origin too, but it's a stupid origin. I reject this.
How do you feel about ginormous? Because I was really excited when that got into the OED.
I like that one.
I mean, I love it because, I have always used and loved the word. And then when it got made fun of for it. So I'm doing my little victory lap over this one now. I just feel like I was ahead of the curve on this whole ginormous.
You were, thing. Man.
Yeah.
I think ginormous is fine. I think the problem I have with Ponage is that it was a misspelling and it became.
Yes.
It became an inner circle type word. And once you put it in the. But you put it in the dictionary, it's not street anymore.
Loses its street cred.
It's like, excuse me, you misused the word ponage, and I have the definition right here. And then you push your glasses up and you say, well, actually, and someone comes through the door and punches you.
Yeah, the OED's getting hip, I guess,
I agree with you, Mur, in that, but I still think that it's better than another edition that they just put in this year, man-spreading. Whereby a man, especially when traveling on public transport, adopts a sitting position with his legs wide apart.
That seems too new. I'm sort of surprised that they went for that one.
I've never heard a soul use that. So.
Me neither.
I have.
I live close enough to New York City that you know, because it's all about, you know, it's all about dudes on the subway, you know.
Yeah, it's a pretty flagrant microaggression when you sit with your legs spread on a subway. And I, no offense to anybody who's actually a social justice warrior, I mean, we now have terms for being an asshole on public transit, I guess, and it's called manspreading. And men are apparently more guilty of it than women, and kind of a dick move. So I'm not sure how it got rushed into the dictionary, but. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it does feel new.
It's not that I oppose it as a word. It's just that it seems pretty new to be suddenly part of the dictionary.
Yeah.
Well, coincidentally, Tom, microaggression was also added.
And,
so was MX, which is a title prior to a person's surname or full name used to avoid specifying gender, which I guess is
well, how do you even pronounce that?
It's, I don't know, MX. MX dot, yeah, MX period.
Hello. So, my goodness. Okay, go, yeah.
So, dictionary is even fatter with controversial words.
No, the OED should tell you how to pronounce it.
It should. I don't have the phonetic spelling here in front of me, though, unfortunately.
I mean, at the risk of sounding like the Rush Limbaugh of the show, at a certain point we twist ourselves into so many knots in order to be accommodating, not offensive, whatever, that it borders on, what, the ludicrous? I don't know. Am I wrong? Is this reasonable? Maybe I'm just old school.
Again, I have seen that in print. I've never seen anyone say that.
Right.
I mean, that does feel unusable.
You know, I can't say that I even use the old school ones that much in speech. Like, I don't think I've ever introduced somebody as like, this is Mr. whoever, because that sounds crazy to me. I think I only call people Mr. something when I'm making fun of them, you know?
You know, I follow a lot of non-binary gender people on Twitter, and I don't think I've ever heard this. The most radical I get is I prefer Ms. because it doesn't require, you know, dudes don't have to say whether they're married in their title, so I don't see why I have to say whether I'm married in my title.
I think guys should use Ms.
Maybe we could just go to M. You know, just have an M dot.
Let's just drop it. Nobody's a master. We're all just generic people. Like, just
we all no suck.
Right.
Well, for me, my frustration on Pwnage is that the only person who's going to ever use it at this point is somebody's dad trying to sound cool.
Yeah, oh, man.
Well, yeah, that was my point. It's anybody who would use it, it took it away from them.
Wait till it filters up to, like, the news. You're going to be watching CNN, like, major Pwnage today on the international politics scene. As President Obama really laid it down on those, Iranians and the nuclear talks. Like, oh, God.
That'll be the day I'll be like, it'll be like Lethal Weapon. I'll be sitting next to my bed, like, just looking at the pistol.
That's fairly morbid, Chris. All right, moving on. Metal Gear Solid 4 is coming out. Metal Gear Solid 5 is coming out very soon. And in all places, Paris has opened a restaurant themed for Metal Gear Solid 5 in anticipation of the release, which I think is pretty cool. And finally, there was a study done of 3,217 people in the U.S. 82% of them agreed that pulling out your cell phone at a social event, dinner, hanging out with friends, a party, whatever, is rude. The problem with that statistic is that 87% of them said that they did that. So
they responded to the survey from their cell phones while having dinner.
Right. But even funnier than that, or what I find weird, is that out of the 3,217 people who responded to the survey, only 3,042 of them were cell phone users. So who the fuck are these people that don't have cell phones? Like, I didn't think that there was 10 people in the country that didn't have cell phones, let alone, you know, 150.
I'm amazed when people don't have smartphones.
Yeah.
Let alone any.
Yeah. Apparently there is that select few out there that refuse.
My best guess is that this is sort of like food is wasted, but it's the other person that's wasting it, not me.
Mm, yeah.
You know, okay. It's rude to do that, but it's rude to do that when it's someone that's not me doing it. If I'm doing it, that's different.
And everybody you talk to is an above average driver.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So everybody drives poorly, but I'm the best, right?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, that wraps up my news. I think that's
all right. For the record, whipping out the phone when we're sitting down at dinner is a macro aggression. It's like,
especially because phones are getting bigger.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If you bring out a phablet, it's definitely a macro aggression.
Yeah. Especially if you're especially if you're man spreading to the people next to you in the booth, right?
In order to pull out your phablet phone.
I didn't
want to keeping it.
Oh man.
I don't want to discount man spreading as a phenomenon, but because I ride transit a lot.
It's real. Yeah, it's a real thing.
It's just like I guess it's mainly men that do it, but I don't think it's. I don't know how that took on a gendered vibe, where as though it was men aggressing against people at large.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, like when I lived in New York for like 6 years, and dudes did it all the time. I don't remember ever seeing a woman do it.
Well, women are generally they're not allowed to sit, you know, sprawled out. So, you know, societal norms, right? So I guess that we're probably. Yeah. There's I answered my own question. That's why it has a gendered sort of connotation.
I mean, we're dicks.
Yeah, I mean, experience.
There's no disputing that. So.
Yeah.
We're jerks, so there's no disputing that either.
For the record, if you man spread, you're an ass. So. Especially if it's crowded, like, come on, man, make some room.
Well, that's why I remember all the times, because I would sit there going like, come on, man, like.
They won't let you sit next. Like, if there's an open seat, they're sprawled into it. They won't even like be considerate and.
Yeah, see, like, what they're talking about is, like, there's a guy who's there, and then, like, if you sit in the right way, you then also block the seat on the two seats on either side of you. So you're actually taking up three seats.
That's a dick move.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'd probably just
get into almost fist fights by, like, crashing into the seat next to them. That's really irritating.
Just sit in his lap.
Yeah, what's up, man?
There you go.
I've been thinking about making, like, inventing some sort of what are the spokes that come out of the chariot in Ben Hur?
Yeah.
Make wheel spikes for women to strap onto their knees, so when they sit down on public transit and dudes try to spread into them, they'll get all torn up by the Ben Hur.
Yes, that'd
be all right.
Sounds like a winner.
Wait, guys, even if there's somebody next to you, they still do it. Like,
oh yeah,
I'm totally trying to contort myself.
That
when borders people
are creepy.
That's disgusting. I don't want to touch anybody on transit. I'm like a pretzel. Like,
I mean, I've done the backpack on the seat next to me kind of trick, you know, but that's as dickish as I'll get. I mean, spreading your legs so that two people won't sit on either side of you—it seems pretty absurd.
Or someone's there and you just invade their space with your stupid knees. God, I hate man spreading. I'm actually glad it's in the dictionary now.
We have a word for our frustrations.
Yeah, I'm going to just use it generically for everything. Hey, quit man spreading all over the schedule this week. What are you doing?
It's not my fault, man.
By the way, I man spreaded out this news segment with all my commentary. Anything else, Cam?
That's it. I'm done.
Okay, cool. Let's get into a discussion with our guest. And Chris, you are the architect of tonight's episode. And so, as I often do when you are the architect, I will probably let you lead the discussion again. And I will just turn it over to you now, Chris.
All right. So part of what I was thinking, it kind of came to me, is that the concept of the serialized story, I don't think we really give it enough credit for being a big foundation for our geeky and pop culture. I mean, the two biggest, oldest, at least for this generation, examples is Star Wars and Indiana Jones. Both of those were based off the cliffhanging, serialized storytelling of the tiny little newsreel movies that used to happen before the main movie at a double feature. That's what impacted George Lucas and Steven Spielberg back in the day. But I mean, you know, comic books or serialized stories, you know, almost up to today. And I can even see where you can say that the way we now tell the great television stories that we're watching with the meta arcs or the story arcs that go beyond just one episode compared to how it was back in the day where everything was in this contained little box for half an hour, an hour, is another form of the serialized story. I mean, it's gotten to the point where I can almost see back in the day, a caveman going, and then Ugh, jump off cliff to avoid tiger. Oh, want to know more? You give me meat at this point. So, I mean, I could just kind of go on. The old Doctor Who series, what was its format? Oh, come on. I haven't been the... Cam, come on. Cam.
No, yeah. I thought it was a rhetorical question.
It was rhetorical. Yeah.
It was a rhetorical question with validation. There we go. There we go. But yeah.
Yes. Yes, Chris. Yes, you're exactly right. Pats on ass.
Oh, I'm a quarterback now. Okay. A verbal quarterback. So, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to dive into is all these ideas and concepts of where serialized storytelling has come from and where it's going. And we got the experts to talk to it about today. So,
go, Brian.
I was about to defer to you, but we're being too nice now. Do you want me to go first? I can get the ball rolling.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. For me personally, I'm like all of us here, it sounds like that, you know, I grew up on a lot of serialized stories. And even before I had any real sense that I wanted to write anything that other people would want to read, I was always interested in doing something like this. And, you know, when this particular project came up, I just jumped at it. I was like, I don't even care what it's about. Like, I just thought that the process was going to be really, really fun, and it really did turn out to be really, really fun. But, I think that we do live in this kind of wonderful golden age where kind of like long form group storytelling is a thing that people like. And, you know, it's, for me, it's pretty exhilarating. I even remember kind of, I'm 40 and I remember talking to people in college going like, God, I just wish that some of these TV shows would just have like 20 episodes and be done. And wouldn't that be great? They could tell a big long story and they'd be like, that's crazy. You know, and now that's like every other TV show. And I do think there's something super compelling about it. It was really fun to put the episodes of Book Burners together, thinking about, you know, how you're going to do like a 16 episode story arc. And in some ways it was probably the most fun I've ever had writing. I mean, in part because when you're writing by yourself, you're kind of never sure if what you're doing is any good. You know, there's always this sense of like, well, you know, there's a good chance I'm going to hand this to somebody else. And they're just going to be like, come on, man. Like nobody wants this. And one of the real pleasures of writing with a bunch of other people is that process was sped up immensely. You know, where if you had a bad idea, they would just be like, that's a bad idea. And then you moved on and you came up with a better idea. And I think that I bet that happens with all the good shows that we see, that they're the process of people weeding out bad ideas and then having to come up with better ideas that everybody likes. And, you know, that's, When that works well, I imagine that's one of the reasons we have. You picture a show like Breaking Bad being written that way, you know, where it's just a kind of this wonderful game of one-upsmanship to see how crazy it can all get, you know, before it's ludicrous. And then you stop it at just the right point. You end up with something that probably none of them could have come up with all by themselves.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely right. The funny thing with me is I've been telling stories serially for a while. Back in 2005, I started releasing my fiction via podcast. And so I would do – and I tried to write it episodically. I didn't just try to podcast a novel. I would try to, you know, write an episode and put it out and then write another episode and put it out. I wouldn't recommend it. It's very difficult to do that.
Sounds harrowing.
Yeah, it was. but I really learned a lot. The really, really funny thing is I can't sell that novel now because everybody says it reads too episodically. Yeah, but that's another story. And so I really liked the episodic storytelling. The exciting thing that Book Burners gave to me was collaboration, because I'd never collaborated with anybody on this level before. And, you know, we started out with I keep calling it a retreat. What does our publisher call it, Brian?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think
he's been saying something else recently.
Really? I thought that was his word at first. Because I think of it, I thought of it that way too, and it's not really a word I tend to use.
Yeah.
So I want to blame someone else for it.
So anyway, he brings us all together to sit for a couple of days, and they were pretty much 12-hour days of talking constantly about our plot lines and our characters and backstories and where we wanted our characters to go, and suddenly flipping genders on characters, and just a variety of discussion. And it was incredibly intense. And I had friends in Boston, which is where we had our first retreat thing, and who were just like, why didn't you tell me you were in town? I'm like, I had no time.
Right. No, I really wasn't.
Really, really had no time. Because by the time the day was done, we were all fried. Just could not, you know, we'd been talking and thinking all day. And, but it was exhilarating. You know, we have a TV writer with us, Margaret Dunlop, and she taught us a whole lot about, you know, using post-it notes and cork boards to tie things together and make all of your ideas visual. And we, like, all of us book writers were like, oh my God, that's brilliant. And we all took pictures of it so we could take it back and use it in our own storytelling when we were all by ourselves. And like Brian said, you don't have a lot of time to second guess your idea, because, you know, we meet frequently to talk about what we're writing about. And so if your idea is crap, then, you know, everybody will tell you that needs work. So, you know, you can go through your process knowing that the team's got your back, which is really, really gratifying.
Yeah. I mean, I think in my case, it definitely encouraged me to just kind of go for it all the time. Because I thought, like, well, if somebody doesn't like it, they'll just tell me. So I might as well just go for it.
Yeah.
You know, see what happens. Yeah. You know, so I was expecting, most of the time, honestly, I was expecting to hand in an episode and have the rest of you go, like, you're off this project.
Man, I thought I was the weak link.
Wow. No, we all felt like we were the weak link, right?
Yes.
But I think what made it fun was that whole idea of knowing that somebody was going to call you out if it was bad. So you might as well just go for it and see what happens.
Wow, so you were all suffering from, what is it, imposter syndrome or something?
Yeah.
Imposter syndrome, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know very few writers who don't, so that's, yeah.
I would be actually worried if somebody didn't, you know, I'd be like, no way.
Clearly there's something wrong with you. You're a sociopath.
Right. It borders
on... comes from the feeling of respect that you have for the other members of your team. Like, I'm with a whole bunch of crazy, great, creative people, and I'm not worthy.
Yeah, that's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's, like, it's kind of like any good, like, team sport kind of thing too, right? Where, like, it's really great to be able to rely on everybody else to that level, you know, where you kind of know where they're, you know, not in a predictable way, but in a very, like, you know, in a very fun and interesting way, that you kind of know where they're going to be, you know, and that you know that any friction that results from somebody calling out your bad idea is going to result in a better idea.
Yeah.
You know, and having faith in that process is what made the whole thing super fun.
But you're not working with, so you're, the people are even tempered and have healthy egos such that they can take criticism and also give criticism without, like, just crapping all over your ideas, right? I mean, I'm assuming there's a element of, there's an ability to play nice there, right? That's required.
Yeah, we have a great team.
I suppose that's right. I mean, I think I remember telling Julian Yap, who's the person who sort of masterminded all of this. I think at the end of our first retreat, I remember talking to him on the phone about something and just being like, you know, good job putting together people that work together this well, you know, because you could see it being just disastrous. And on the other hand, I think you'd know that really quickly. Like, there'd probably be about 10 minutes into the first meeting.
Right.
Yeah.
You'd be like, yeah, this isn't gonna happen.
I could see. Yeah. The non-imposter writer comes like sauntering in, slaps a manuscript down. We're done here. Just print it.
Yeah. Right. Or the person who just like sort of browbeats you into like their particular ideas
the constantly. Bully, yeah.
You know, without sure. sort of being like, well, what if we did this and what if we did this, which is really what the conversation was more like. You know, it was just, let's throw ideas around until everybody's excited, you know?
Yeah.
Was there a screening process, do you know, when it came to assembling the team, or was it just, did the single point of contact know that these are all reasonable people? I'm really interested in how you get together a collaborative and compatible team like this.
Well, I was chosen because I'm friends with Max Gladstone, who was our lead writer. And I think Julian and Max are old friends. So Julian was talking to Max about who should be on the team. And I believe Max chose me. I think Julian knew Margaret through other sources. Julian knows a lot of people.
Mm.
I'm not sure how Brian joined the team. So you go, Brian.
I got into this because Julian is friends with my editor at Tor.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But it's a similar thing. I mean, I suspect that Julian was kind of following an intuition of some sort. You know, it may be as simple as like, well, I like all of these people. So the chances of them all getting along are pretty good.
Yeah. You
know, it could have been as simple as that. But I have to say, I'm not really sure what the logic was, aside from, you know, and the reason I don't is because it was working, you know, so it's good not to ask too many questions about
it.
No, I think the intuition sounds like what brought the team together, and it's great that it did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Murr, I think it's interesting you said that you started out, what, you said 2002, doing like podcast sort of episodic
2005.
I guess 2005 installations of your novel. And this is just me as a consumer. You guys are the experts. I by no means have any, you know, empirical evidence as to this, but I feel like just as a consumer that over the last 5, 7, 10 years has been the direction that most writers have gone in terms of getting their product and their content out into the world. Just to name a couple, like Scott Siegler, Patrick E. McLean, Patio Books. It seems like there's tons of writers on there that are just giving away content, but then it's like, okay, well, if you like this, like, here's my book, go buy it on Amazon. And it seems to me to be, you know, pretty successful. I was just wondering how you guys saw it.
I'd say that, you know, the podcast has built my audience for sure. Has it equated to sales? I don't know if it equated to sales to the level my publisher wanted it to, but I do know that a lot of my fans did buy my book. It's a very weird thing, this sort of, you like to think of it as an unspoken contract that if I give you content now, perhaps you'll reward me in the future by buying it. And it's not a contract that anybody signs. Mm-hmm. And so you can, you know, give out your soul and have nobody buy anything, or you could, you know, have become a bestseller. There are so many different variables. It's kind of difficult to track.
Gotcha. Well, because I know for sure, like, that's how I sort of found some of those writers, and I, you know, listened to some of their podcasts, and I was like, wow, I like really like this story. And, you know, they put on, you know, say there's a series of 3 or 4 books, they'll put 1 or 2 on there, and then you finish those, and you're like, well, shit, now I gotta go buy the 3rd and 4th book. You know what I mean? And I did end up doing that. So
wait, who's putting out like books 1 and 2 and not 3 and 4 via podcast?
Scott Siegler.
No, Scott podcasts everything.
Well, the Intergalactic Football League series, the last one was not up. It might have been in the early stages that he was doing it, Maybe I didn't want to wait. That probably was what it was.
Yeah, probably, because yeah. Scott podcasts everything.
Yeah.
He still has it in his contract with his publisher to podcast the stuff that he sells. So, yeah, if it's not out, it's coming out.
Gotcha. Yeah,
I can promise you that.
I guess I was just impatient then. but I definitely did buy a couple of his books because I was like, well, I mean, shit, I can't wait, for the weekly episodes to come out.
Man, yeah, that's the hope, that people can't wait, and it's there to buy if you want to go ahead and buy the whole thing.
Entitled Fan Cam.
Exactly.
Oh, we know all about the entitled fans. People who complain about the free ice cream. Oh, yeah.
As long as it's vanilla, I don't complain.
Nice.
You get a free balloon and you complain about the color. It's a free balloon. Take it. Well, for me, reading stuff from back in the day, somehow I could see this collaboration, I mean, being able to be flipped and easily used for the old style shared universe anthologies too.
Yeah.
Like Thieves World and stuff like that.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't remember us talking about any of this stuff very much among ourselves, Mer. I think that I mostly thought of this as resuscitating an old thing rather than sort of doing a new thing. And I saw that as good.
Yeah.
Let's see if this old idea has legs, at this point in history, kind of a thing, yeah. Rather than let's reinvent some medium, which I don't think any of us are under any illusions that we're doing that.
No, I kind of saw it as, well, it worked for Dickens, so.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was thinking along the lines of Dickens or the Conan.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. Or I thought of all those kind of old sword and sorcery magazines and things like that. That, growing up as a kid, I loved.
Yeah. Serializing and cliffhangers are a very old concept. And what's funny is we don't use a lot of cliffhangers, even though we are a serial story. I guess we kind of do near the end, which is good, but I didn't see us as doing a whole lot of cliffhangers in our writing.
I actually tried to do a couple of them, and then somehow or another, people would be like, this thing needs to be buttoned up at the end, and I thought, okay. So I buttoned it up. But, at some point, if this goes on long enough, I will literally end an episode with somebody hanging from a cliff. There we go. I'll be like, there.
That'll show them.
Edit that out.
Are there certain rules for what is considered a reasonable cliffhanger? Like, is there a certain level of satisfaction? Like, what is it I'm trying to say? I should just leave that as a cliffhanger and let you interpret what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think. Oh, I got to be careful here because I'm just editing this episode, so it's fresh in my mind. We were very. I guess you could call it like X-Files, what they call it, the monster of the week. We do a lot of that in the beginning to set characters and scene and everything. But then by the end, the main arc is barreling along. And so we get to, I have our characters going through a major adventure. And at the end of, it's the end of the story, it's a complete story. And so they're all, okay, whew, that's over. And then somebody alarming comes through the door. And that's in essence something that happens. And so, and then Brian takes over and Brian tells his story from that point of the people coming through the door and he ends it in another way. And, but I think the deal with cliffhangers is you've got people writing in the same time frame. And that gets really, really tough because even though we're all collaborating on the story and what we're eventually talking about, we're all writing our own episodes. But near the end, it's like, okay, this really big thing has to happen. And so, Brian's story starts the second mine ends. And so, near the end, we had to be very, very careful with the continuity, making sure that the proper things were placed in mine. I planted the seeds that Brian could then water, that Margaret then... the metaphor is breaking down, but there's plants involved and stuff. So I think doing that kind of cliffhanger thing all the time is pretty difficult if you've got writers who live all over the world or country.
I think at one point I started thinking of it more as like a relay race, right? Where it's
yes.
like you want to make sure those handoffs are as smooth as possible. Uh-huh. And like sometimes that could mean that, you know, you want to build some tension, but I think as often as not, it was mostly about sort of like, it was just like set it up, like set up the next episode, set up the next episode. And like whether that felt like a cliffhanger or whether it felt like a resolution to the episode was almost sort of beside the point. You know, it was more about making sure that the next person had what they needed to, like, you know, to tell their part of the story.
Yeah.
I see.
And that was, to me, that was like both, it was simultaneously the most frustrating and most rewarding part of the project. You know, it was frustrating in the sense that, you know, I had thought that I had done my job, and it turned out I had to do stuff, you know, I had to do more, you know, but that's a good thing. You know, it's people go, wait a minute, you gotta make sure that this is here and this is here and this is here. And like, you immediately see that they do. And then you think about the sleep you're going to lose because you have to do more work than you thought.
But that's how you grow as a writer, right?
But yeah, and you know, that's how we grow as writers and people.
Losing sleep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Developing your caffeine habit.
So that a comment earlier brought up a question in my mind. So, especially for Murr, who's done both ends of doing it episodically by herself and then with a team, the whole using the monster of the week to sort of start the engine going at the beginning, is that a cliche? Is that a trope? Is that maybe part of the framework of doing a serialized story?
I think it's an important, I don't know, is trope a bad word? I'm not sure.
I don't think of trope as bad.
I think of cliche as an overused trope.
Word.
Well, sometimes you got to wonder, like, if something's a trope or something's just part of storytelling. I mean, is the hero's journey a cliche, or is it a trope, or is it just part of storytelling? The thing about the Monster of the Week is, you know, when beginning writers try to start stories and they have like, okay, let's start it with a gunshot and someone running away and it's really tense. And it's like, I don't give a crap about this character. I don't know who they are. I don't know who they want, what they want. You just got me really excited running down the street. And I feel like if you start a story immediately with cliffhangers, immediately with, oh my God, what's going to happen next? Then, you know, you're asking people to invest too much emotion before they give a crap. And so the Monster of the Week is a way to cement, here's this person, here's their story. Oh, wait, there's something weird about this person. Let's reveal it in episode 7. And then once the cliffhangers start falling, people care enough to come back.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah.
That's the hope.
But to keep going on that, like, I think for me, what I enjoyed is like, I mean, I happen to love sort of like great, I think that there's a lot of pleasure in like great genre exercises, right? Where you kind of know how it's going to turn out, but like the fun is all in the details. You know, it's the whole like, well, what makes them think they have a new spin on this? But when somebody does, it's very exciting. And for me, I think because, you know, I love Monster of the Week stuff. When I think of how much TV I've watched that is essentially Monster of the Week things, right?
Yeah.
One after the other, like, I've never gotten tired of it. Yeah. Like, so long as like there's something fresh that I haven't seen before. And it was really fun, you know, even specifically to come up with like, I want to make a monster that I haven't seen. You know, and that was really, really, really fun for me to do, as it turned out.
Brian is very good at inventing the monsters we haven't seen.
Well, you guys gave me the license to do it. When I was like, I write the second episode, which is the first, like, yeah, there's a pilot, and then there's like the first Monster of the Week episode. And at the very end of our first meeting in Boston, I remember asking them, I was like, so do you want this to feel sort of like familiar, or do you want it to feel like, I mean, well, you can decide whether you want to leave this in here. Like, do you want it to just feel like, you know, what the fuck is this? And they went for the second one, and I thought, okay, great. You know, I'm gonna really go for it. And I succeeded in disgusting my wife with the first draft, which felt like I had accomplished something. And then, you know, but it was really fun. I mean, it was fun to sort of like bat around ideas, even for what the creature looks like, and then think, actually, I'm ripping off this thing. I can't do that. You know, I got to try something else until I came up with something where I was like, I don't really know what that is anymore. And that's when I felt like I'd gotten somewhere good, you know.
Great. So, for me, I think an interesting question is with the serialized story. We mentioned Dickens, we mentioned Coyle, but, you know, now we have comic books. So we have serialized stories that have become classics. But as far as I know, those are all kind of, you know, they've been approved by time, so to speak. They're like, you know, Victorian era stuff. What do you guys think is going to have to happen to get the serialized stories now and in the future to become that level of classic? Go for it. Come on.
You want to go for that one first?
Oh, not at all, but I will. I suck.
I can go for it first, and then you can tell me how I'm wrong.
I don't know. I'm so bad at predictions. Here, I'll tell you how bad I am at predictions. You know the game Rainbow Six?
Yeah.
Yeah. I worked at Red Storm when that was being designed, and I thought it was the stupidest idea ever. So that can tell you how well I look into the future.
Oh, don't be harsh on yourself like that, Murr.
No, I'm telling the truth. I thought it was a stupid idea. I thought tactical crap, man. You want to go in there and you want to shoot somebody in the face. No, the tactical thing was a big hit. I am not good at looking into the future and telling what's going to be big. So I really hope that the people who are on the business side of Cereal Box do their job, and, you know, I have faith that we did our job, and I hope that what they do gets it in front of people and into their hands, and they get and want more. That's all I got.
Now, I was just talking to someone about this sort of thing the other day about how, you know, I think that when we look back at, you know, someone like Charles Dickens, it feels like a done deal, right? Where it's like you read it and you're like, well, I understand why, you know, why this has lasted, and at the same time you understand why it was super popular at the time, right? But then it's weird because you can make the same argument where you like you read, say, like, I don't know, the example that's coming to mind is Moby Dick, because everybody hated it when it came out, and they thought it was stupid and it didn't make any sense. And then, like, you know, 25 years later, suddenly everybody decides it's a classic. Like, I think what's super fun about this whole, about that whole longevity game is that it's like crazy unpredictable. You know, it's one of those, like, you never know why something lasts and something else doesn't. And it's, you know, as someone who makes stuff, you know, part of the real fun of it is of not knowing. You know, it's like, I think that every writer has their audience and like some sort of audience in mind, right? And there's your sense of like, well, I'm writing for this sort of person, or maybe you're writing for a lot of people or whatever it is, but you're sort of just banking on the idea that this like construct exists out there that is going to be into what you're doing. And it can be pretty maddening, but also very thrilling, you know, to sort of bank on that sense of like, well, there's somebody out there who's going to like this, and possibly for this, even for the reasons I think they're going to like it.
So, Mr. Reed, do you have any questions?
Nothing that hasn't been answered. I mean, sorry, I'd love to contribute, but I'm kind of absorbing.
There's a lot of good stuff to absorb.
Yeah, there is.
Unacceptable. You must pose a question.
Actually, like one of the things I was talking about with a friend the other day is how like how it's pretty awesome that someone like Robert E. Howard, people still read that guy. Like, he's not necessarily somebody you would have picked at the time, you know, as being like, oh yeah, in 100 years, everyone's still going to be reading those stories. But there's something in them, right? There's something that, you know, whatever it is, like, they're problematic in so many ways, and in so many ways they haven't aged very well. And then in other ways, there is like, they're just super potent. You know, there's some magic in there that like keeps you coming back. You know, there's sentences that stop you in your tracks, and there's ideas in there that, you know, that are as thrilling now as they were then.
And my 12-year-old daughter, I'm sorry, Brian, go on.
No, go, you go ahead.
My 12-year-old daughter is reading P.G. Wodehouse. She loves it. So there's some sort of the last century humor that is still speaking to even the kids of today. I don't know how many of her friends are reading it, but she is reading it and really getting into it. So,
and somebody is, right? That's what's cool about it. It's like there's somebody out there reading it.
Well, you know, speaking of the future, what I look forward to is a point where we can have some sort of integrated bookmarking technology where I can be like reading my e-episode or ebook and then bookmark it. And then I go into the car and then I just switch over to the audiobook. Click on the same bookmark, and now the story continues, but it's switched formats from reading to being an audiobook, and then back again when I'm out of the car.
That exists.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, if you have to buy via Audible and Kindle.
Oh, okay.
That does exist, yes. It's pretty awesome.
The future is now.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you just have to, you know, sell your soul to Amazon to make it happen.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, an interesting side effect of being a serialized story is I know that when they were doing the Kindle Unlimited thing, and it was based off the old system of you could just read 10% of the story, and you could, you know, then you'd get your full amount of reimbursement. So people started making quick serialized stories so they could, you know, if I have a 10-page short story that's serialized, then people just have to read one or two pages, and then that, boom, that's it. I get my cash, we move on to the next one. So.
How much did Amazon pay for your soul, Chris?
Oh, I am not doing unlimited. Looked at that with a crook with.
Just giving you green.
Not, the answer is not. But you know, it's disappointing because I've got sales on Kindle, but everywhere else I have it to be, you know, going to go against the man and have a wide market, nothing. Nothing on the other stuff. It's kind of sad.
Or you're down on the terms offered by Amazon, or Amazon?
Yeah, I remember when they started it and they kept saying, we're putting X million dollars into this program. And I said, but you haven't told me how many people are going to be in the program. If you're putting $2 million in the program and then you're inviting 2 million authors to put their books on, I get a dollar. Yay. So, and they just kept talking. It's every single thing said, here's how much money we're putting into this program, and not a word on what you could expect to get. And I was leery and I didn't go for it.
And for Amazon, 3 million is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
That's like bird feed.
Yes, but they're a famously frugal organization, so doesn't surprise me that they would be dealing in drops in buckets rather than entire buckets. That's a discussion for another time, huh?
Oh, yeah, we could go off on that one for a while.
I'll ask one final question that occurred to me before we allow our guests to resume their careers. And if this has been asked, then we will just clip it out of the episode and it will have never occurred. Does the short attention span that was alluded to during our discussion of MMORPGs functioning as chat programs for people waiting to play League of Legends factor into serialized release? Are people able to read in small chunks more readily these days, given that, you know, we all know all the kids require medication to pay attention to anything, or so the media would have you believe. Does that mean that the serialized format arrived at the right time? Re-arrived, I should say. It's coming back onto the scene at the right time.
No, I think it's true. It's smaller stories and, or at least longer short stories, and the serial is a nice bite-sized dopamine hitting chunk where you can get your story. You don't have to concentrate too much on it, but it makes your brain want more. In theory, we're hoping, but I think that's why the longer short stories and novellas are coming back.
Brian, do you concur?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the, like, when we were putting the episodes together, we definitely kind of always had an eye on the stopwatch, you know, of like, how long is it going to take a person to read this thing? And we did, you know, we did kind of have a cap, you know, to make sure that, you know, you think of it as like, you can read it on a, you know, a subway ride, or you can read it on the way to work, you know, that sort of thing. And I do think so. I mean, you know, I guess I go back and forth because it seems like at the same time people like love those like ginormous. See, I got to use it for real. people love those like, you know, huge ginormous books that you can get lost in and like all of that. But at the same time, like I do think that, I mean, for me personally, the stuff that I'm reading is getting shorter and shorter because of that sort of thing. Like I don't have the time for a super, super long thing at this point in my life. Maybe someday I will again, and that would be great. But there's been real pleasure in discovering just how much short fiction is out there now. And I'm probably not that unusual in not having a lot of spare time, you know?
Yeah.
I actually agree. Anybody else want to chime in on that?
Well, I mean, I've said this many times before. I'm shocked that anyone even reads anything these days. So I think it's good that people are reading. And I think it was Brian that said, I won't be surprised if, you know, in 5 years we've got a book just of emoticons.
Yeah.
no words, just emoticons. So I applaud any efforts for, you know, getting people to read.
The reviews for that book will be written in emoticons as well.
Yeah.
Clappy smile. Cute
face, sad face.
Yes. Crying cat, says the New York Times. Oh, God. All right. That was pretty much all I had as far as any remaining questions. Do any of my co-hosts want to turn the screws to the guests anymore, or should we let them be on their way?
Well, I think that's all I got.
Awesome. Guys, anything you want to discuss, plug, promote, etc. before we wrap it up?
Unfortunately, not me, just book burners.
Yeah, let's keep on message here. I agree. I think we should be plugging book burners and seeing what happens.
And where can they find book burners?
I don't even know. What's our website?
Bookburners is available through the Serial Box website. The pilot, which Max Gladstone wrote, is available now. And then the official release is next week. And the episodes will be available, I believe, once a week after that. So, you know, essentially like watching a TV show. And hopefully a really good TV show.
And I believe the pilot is for free.
It is. That's right. It's Serial as in Serial. Serial Box.
For all the sub-80s out there, just to clarify.
Yes, yeah,
it's not C-E-R-E-A-L.
That's right.
For all the people who thought we were actually talking about stories delivered on the back of like Rice Krispies boxes for this entire episode. Yeah.
Where's my prize?
Yeah, sorry, everybody.
That's when I knew I was probably doomed to be a writer, when I would actually go and read that stuff. Read anything that came across my way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You read the Snap, Crackle, and Pop stories on the back of the...
Yes.
Those sure are pretty did. Good. It always ended up with them eating cereal, which...
What a
which
shock.
Is weird, right?
Yeah.
You know, romance is always end with a happy ever after, so happy yeah. ending. So,
makes I mean, sense.
It's just like romance tropes. It's cereal tropes.
We defeated the Sog Monsters and got to enjoy some delicious Rice Krispies. Yeah. All right. God. Awesome. I guess with that plug out of the way, and I will encourage readers to pop over. I will encourage.
Good one.
I will encourage readers to snap, crackle, and pop over and check that out.
Before we let anybody go, Brian, did you want to name the radio station, or is it too early for that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the one I work for?
The one you're building.
Yeah, I mean, it's a radio station called it's called WNHH. It's in New Haven, Connecticut. So it's through the New Haven Independent. And, WNHH is what we could get after, you'd be amazed how many call letters have been taken in the FCC's history. So that was as close as we could get to a good sort of acronym for New Haven. But it's just WNHH. 103.5 FM if you're ever driving through New Haven, Connecticut.
Is it on any online medium like yes. iHeart or anything like that?
For sure. Yeah, everything is also streamed and podcasted and all of those good things.
Awesome.
Which is where all the sound geekery really comes in.
For sure.
Very cool. That's two good plugs. And if you guys don't want to plug anything else, we will let you be gone.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thanks so much for having us on.
No, thanks for coming on, guys. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. This was fun.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely. I
think I speak for everybody else. We had fun on our side too.
Absolutely.
Good.
This was good. I mean, usually I'm like, authors, my eyes roll. You know, they come. Like they're big words, and then.
I save all my big words for the stories. I just, you know, talk in monosyllables in real life.
It's appreciated. But seriously, it was great having you on. And definitely, if you want to come on again, we are known to let guests come back. So
sweet.
Consider it.
Excellent.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
thank you guys.
Really appreciate thank you. It. Take yep. care.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, guys, another excellent episode in the can. Our guests were above average, as our guests always are, I would say. And definitely encourage our listeners to check out Cereal Box. And while their mind is on things cereal, they should consider checking out our podcast on a regular basis. Think of each episode as a book, which is guaranteed not to contain anything that will do you harm. And if you want to check any of those innocuous little books out, do so either using iTunes or, if you are more inclined to listen via streaming, Stitcher.
Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, add us to your Google Plus circle, and join us at the Nerdstravaganza HQ Facebook group.
If you're feeling fruity, grab your pebbles and head on over to nerdstravaganza.com. Then loop on over to YouTube, type in Nerdstravaganza into the search bar and check out all of our video content. And then shoot us an email at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com and tell me how much you hate my cereal puns.
And with all that said, Chris, ride us out of here.
Now, son, you really pwned that bowl of cereal this morning.
Major pwnage.
Pwned to the max.